Would you like to help a college or seminary student attend the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference? You can purchase a conference scholarship for a contribution of $120 to Issues Etc. You can donate online at issuesetc.org/scholarship, or you can make your $120 check payable to Issues Etc., write scholarship in the memo line, and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. They've been very successful, haven't they? The activists and the proponents of the sexual revolution have learned a lot in that long fight, that struggle that they've been engaged in American culture and society and the courtroom. They've learned a lot and they have refined their technique. They managed in the course of less than 10 years to take something like same-sex marriage from unthinkable, both socially, morally, and legally, to, well, of course, there's same-sex marriage. Hasn't there always been same-sex marriage? Why wasn't there same-sex marriage before all of these legal actions in a Supreme Court decision? That's pretty successful arguing. How did they do it? Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're going to talk about the indoctrination of children into the sexual revolution. Matthew Cochran joins us. He's a software engineer. He holds a Master in Arts degree from Concordia Theological Seminary. He's author of the blog, The 96th Thesis, and a column for The Federalist titled, How Schools Quietly Indoctrinate Your Kids on Abortion and Transgenderism. Matthew, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
You've written recently that the legal and social cultural victory of the proponents of same-sex marriage is an example of how to win by framing the question. Explain what you mean.
Well, when any kind of argument, when you're considering the rhetoric of it, just as important as what is said is how it is said, how the argument is framed. Kind of the classic example of that is, you know, that loaded question that we've all heard, you know, so have you stopped beating your wife, right? The question itself assumes that a beating has taken place in the past. And however you answer that, if you answer the question, if you answer yes or you answer no, you are implicitly accepting that unspoken assertion that this violence happened in the past, right? So simply by framing the question or framing the debate in a specific way, you can make certain assertions about it that often go by unnoticed and undebated. And you can see that in a lot of the cultural changes that we've been experiencing here in the West. The one I mentioned in the article is the issue of gay marriage. From the beginning, the left was able to frame that debate as, well, should we allow homosexuals to marry? And then the right answered, well, no, we should not allow homosexuals to marry. And the left said, of course, well, yes, we should allow homosexuals to marry. Well, what's the implicit statement there? Is that it is entirely possible for one man to marry another man. That's an implicit assumption that was worked into the way the debate was framed that really both sides just kind of went with. And because both sides went with it, that's become the cultural assumption now. Certainly that's a majority opinion of Americans at the moment, and that's quickly becoming the majority opinion even among Christians, among evangelicals, and so forth. Because of the way that it was framed. Once you say that, oh yeah, you know, a man can marry another man, no problem, it's really, really hard to argue why they shouldn't be allowed to. Why are you going to stop them from doing that? Right? But that's the way the debate went. And given that, it's not terribly surprising that we've lost it so badly. That's not the only way it could have been framed. There are lots of different ways. But for example, you could just as easily say, you know, I don't think the government should be allowed to force people to pretend that two men are married to each other. That's another way of framing the same question. There's a different assumption. The assumption there, of course, is that men can't be married. That's pretense. And it diverts the question back to the issues of religious liberty and freedom of speech and these other important issues. That would be a way of framing it that's more consistent with what Christians teach, with what conservatives tend to believe. But for the most part, we haven't looked at these other ways of framing these questions. We've allowed the left, we've allowed the media, and our cultural institutions to frame that for us. And we've accepted far too much from them, and that's a big part of the reason why we're losing.
So it was a classic example of moving the goalposts. They simply said, why are you preventing us from doing this? That they almost acted as though there was a time when men could marry men and women could marry women, and we've entered this benighted age when that's somehow being stopped. People being stopped from doing what is ordinarily would have been done. You almost got the impression that they thought something, a right had been taken away from them when they were making the argument.
Exactly. That's the way that it sounds. That's certainly not the case. The idea that a man could marry another man is absurd, and most people throughout human history would have recognized how absurd that is. Whether it's our traditions about marriage, whether it's, you know, marriage in the civilizational sense of you know, building a society, whether it's marriage in the Christian sense, whether it's marriage in the natural law sense, that idea of a man marrying a man or a woman marrying a woman, that's completely alien to all of those different senses. And so most people would recognize it as absurd, and throughout history, if the question came up at all, it would have been recognized that way. But today, a lot of people are accepting that. They're accepting various absurdities, it's true. And that doesn't just happen overnight. People don't just start believing absurd things for no reason. There has to be a motivation, and there also has to be a lot of preparation going into that, priming people to believe this sort of thing.
So how does this play into your observations about the indoctrination of our children, largely through classes in public school, into the sexual revolution?
It's a little bit of an old, kind of old news, I guess you could say, that sex education courses or health class or personal development or whatever you call them, that these classes have been part of public schooling for a while now. They were controversial when they started, but now they're kind of an accepted fact of the curriculum. And most Christians have always been aware that, yeah, a lot of the stuff that they teach there is not at all consistent with Christian virtue of chastity or anything with sexual morality. And more, now that that's the norm, now that that's simply the accepted way of doing things, these classes are being used to teach even more and more absurd things. And they're doing so with the same kind of rhetorical device, the same, not necessarily by stating it right out, because, you know, that can cause some controversy. You know, if you teachers, you know, tell a kid straight out, you know, abortion is fine. It's totally okay to do that. You might get complaints about that. They're going to come home and tell their parents. It could cause some controversy. But if you frame the curriculum in a way that just assumes that, you're teaching the kids, and they're not even necessarily realizing that that is what they're being taught. And the parents are more likely than not also not realizing that that is what's being taught.
Matthew Cochran is our guest. We're talking about the indoctrination of children into the sexual revolution. When we come back, we're going to give an example of framing the curriculum in just that way. Stay tuned.
Teacher said to me, and that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. And what did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine?
You'll find major discounts on previous Issues Etc. books of the month during Concordia Publishing House's Spring Warehouse Sale. The Reformation by Dr. Cameron McKenzie for $15. A Year with the Church Fathers by Dr. Scott Murray for $10. 5 Things You Can Do to Appreciate Science and Love the Bible by Charles St. Ange for $5. Hundreds of items reduced during Concordia Publishing House's Spring Warehouse Sale, May 3rd through the 7th, cph.org, cph.org.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world, LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, is the Lutheran Federal Credit Union Ministry of the Month. During May, if you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or if you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to Concordia Theological Seminary. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran Federal Credit Union, LutheranFCU.org.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the indoctrination of children into the sexual revolution. Matthew Cochran is our guest. Before the break, you were talking about how in schools, the curriculum can sometimes be framed the same way the arguments in society in the courtroom are framed. Give us an example of the framing of the curriculum to advance the ideas of the sexual revolution.
Well, I countered this. A friend of mine from my church, actually, his granddaughter was in junior high at a nearby public school, and she had just been about to take this personal development course. Again, like health class or sex ed, it's a little broader than that, but that's the basic idea. And as usual, the AB school sent out a notification of, hey, this is what the next thing we're going to be covering in class to the parents so that they understood what was going on. And gave a list of, yeah, we're going to be covering, you know, pregnancy and STDs and the usual stuff, along with a few more red flag items, like, you know, gender identity and sexual orientation and that sort of thing. So the mother, she did what any good mother is going to do. She's going to ask some questions about that. She asked the teacher exactly are you going to be teaching our kids. And she got a few more details from the teacher, but then the teacher pointed her to the curriculum that the school district was using and invited her to come in and take a look at and see exactly what's going on there. And as it turns out, the curriculum, it's called the Rights, Respect, Responsibility, a K-12 sexual education curriculum. And it was developed by a far left political advocacy organization. It's called Advocates for Youth. And the entire curriculum was built around these deceptive rhetorical devices to teach a lot of falsehoods, kind of toxic sexual immorality with respect to with abortion, with transgenderism, and a number of other issues. And again, doing it in a way, not by teaching it straight out, but by framing it in a specific way. For example, abortion was never listed as one of the topics they were going to cover. And the curriculum never actually uses the word abortion. But it does broach the subject when it talks about pregnancy. Quoting from this here, it says, say to the students, once a person confirms they are pregnant, they need to decide whether they are going to have the baby and become a parent, have the baby and let someone adopt it, or end the pregnancy at its earliest stage. The second two options are available for a number of reasons, including that the pregnant person may not feel they would be able to take care of a baby because of their age or life circumstances. Now, when it's talking about ending the pregnancy, it's talking about abortion, even if it doesn't use this word. And even though it doesn't say abortion, it brings in that entire pro-abortion mindset in through the back door. Because if you're saying, well, once a person realizes they're pregnant, they have to decide whether they're going to be a parent. Well, you're assuming then that they're not a parent already, that there's not already a child there. That's the pro-abortion position on there. They don't say it, but it's assumed in the way that they're framing it. It's a rhetorical sleight of hand that's going on there. When a parent is choosing to abort, they're not choosing whether or not to become a parent. They are a parent choosing what to do with their child that they already have. And in that same vein, when it talks about, it's like, oh, you know, the third option, of course, is to, you know, end the pregnancy. Well, yeah, you know, abortion does end a pregnancy, but doesn't really talk about how abortion ends a pregnancy by deliberately killing an innocent human being. It makes it sound like, oh, yeah, it's just one of the normal outcomes of pregnancy is that it ends. Well, not exactly. It's like talking about murder and saying, oh, well, you know, death is a natural part of life. No, murder is not natural. And abortion is not natural. It's not a normal part of the pregnancy. But they're presenting it as though it's just this, oh, you know, you found this, you know, computer pop-up, you know, you found out you're pregnant, you know, click okay to proceed or cancel to end the pregnancy. They don't mention the controversy, any of the moral weight that comes with deliberately choosing to end a life. All of that's glossed over, and it's all you're left with is just the simple assumption that there's no baby there yet, and that ending the pregnancy is just a normal part of how pregnancies work.
There's also, you point out, some rather subtle and not so subtle use of pronouns and nouns that you think are at least laying the groundwork for transgender advocacy.
Yes, you might have noticed when I was reading the quote earlier that I said, you know, once a person confirms they're pregnant, and, you know, the pregnant person may not feel they would be able to take care of a baby. That's a really odd way of phrasing, isn't it? Uniform human experience would suggest to us that we're talking about pregnant women. But, of course, that doesn't mesh with transgenderism. And that is another big deception that's going on throughout this curriculum. And this is deliberate. It states as a note to the teacher in there that, you know, language is important and that they've taken a lot of care to avoid any kind of specifically gendered speech. They use they instead of him or her. They use gender-neutral names, that sort of thing. And they say pregnant person, even though pregnant woman would be a much more precise and natural way of describing it. And again, they say straight out, this is intended to make the curriculum inclusive of all genders and gender identities. And then they encourage the teachers to use this basically as much as they can get away with. So yeah, you have all those pronouns when you're talking about pregnancy. It's a pregnant person as opposed to a pregnant woman, contrary to what biology would suggest. And they certainly get a lot more explicit later on. It keeps that gender-neutral groundwork throughout, but then later on they have this lesson on gender stereotypes is basically how it's presented. It's called Blue is for Boys, Pink is for Girls. Or are they? And basically the class is told that they need to come up with a list of stereotypes for boys and girls. You know, boys like to watch football and girls, you know, like ballet, or boys like blue, girls like pink. Boys play with trucks, girls play with dolls, that sort of thing, right? So students are supposed to come up with this list of stereotypes and talk about exceptions to the stereotypes. Of course, that's how stereotypes work. Not everybody conforms to that. They're naturally fluid. And from there, then the teacher goes on to say that, well, you know, there are also people who don't identify as boys or girls, but as transgender or genderqueer, which means that, you know, basically they were assigned to be called a boy or girl at birth. And they might have body parts that are typically associated with being a boy or girl, but they feel different. And again, at the tail end of that discussion, the rhetorical effect of that is to say that, you know, you're quote unquote assigned a gender at birth, or, you know, your genitalia are associated with being a boy or associated with being a girl, just like any other stereotype. So they've made this this transition there from like, oh yeah, you know, some boys, you know, boys generally like football, boys generally play with trucks, boys generally have penises. They basically lump all those together as just different stereotypes. And of course, that's a huge rhetorical sleight of hand. Their biological sex is not a stereotype. Biological sex is not fluid like stereotypes are. And conflating the two in that way is a very intellectually dishonest way of presenting this information. And it's one of those things where it lays the groundwork when later on in the curriculum, they come straight out and say that, you know, yeah, if a boy thinks he's a girl, he's really a girl. That's an absurd thing to say. To think that a boy is a girl just because he thinks he is, that's absurd. But if you go through all these different grades of K through 12, and they lay down these rhetorical deceptions all along the way, it's not going to feel absurd by the time that you hear that. And they do get more explicit in, this is the junior high curriculum, but they can get more explicit in the high school one, towards the end of the high school classes. But the entire thing is set up around laying this kind of groundwork down so that when they come out with the absurdities later on, they don't sound absurd anymore. And kids are much more likely to believe that and have it make sense to them. And the parents aren't going to know that this is going on because of the more subtle way that this is being presented.
Finally, with about 30 seconds here, Matthew, how would you briefly caution parents toward vigilance on this?
You always want to be involved in your kids' education. But the question I ask at the end of the article is, if you have to keep watch over them, you know, you have to go and look at the curriculum and, you know, try to exempt them from classes and try to figure out exactly what they're teaching them, and you have to police them to that extent, should you really be trusting your kids to them in the first place? And that's the question that I think every parent needs to ask themselves, no matter where they're sending their kids. The system, the public school system, regardless of, you know, what any specific individual in that system may be like, the system is in many ways designed to teach false philosophies to your children. That is a huge, that's not just a risk, that is a danger. And you have to be aware of that, first of all, but also aware of the fact that simply knowing about it doesn't avoid it. You need to, if you have a good reason to entrust your kids to these people, you need to know what's going to be happening to them. And you need to make sure that that reason outweighs the huge danger that they're being placed in.
Matthew Cochran is a software engineer. He holds a Master in Arts degree from Concordia Theological Seminary. He's author of the blog, The 96th Thesis, and a column for The Federalist titled, How Schools Quietly Indoctrinate Your Kids on Abortion and Transgenderism. You'll find a link to it under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
In Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., Pastor Chris Roseborough joins us. It'll be this week in Pop American Christianity. We're going to talk about how some evangelical leaders are taking up the story of the Garden of Gethsemane, finding themselves and you right in the center of it. Then we'll play Issues, Etc., Soundbite of the Week.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.